Every Sunday morning growing up, my dad made us pancakes. We'd wake up to the smell of the baking batter and trudge out to the kitchen to eat together. And we always, always topped our pancakes with pure maple syrup and would turn up our noses at anything else. It might be a silly childhood memory, but to me this proves how deeply food is woven into the culture of Wisconsin. In our state, food is part of our identity. Well, farmers responsible for our Wisconsin food have felt the effects of climate change. Take sugar maples, for example. Because the tapping season is dependent on weather conditions, maple syrup production is particularly vulnerable to changes in climate. Warming temperatures, changes in precipitation, and changes in freeze and thaw cycles will impact maple trees and syrup productions. Today on the West Side, we're celebrating Earth Day by talking about how changes in the environment and consumer behavior impact Western Wisconsin farmers. I'm Claire Neipert. Good to have you with us today. Joining us today are Randy Rickle, a beekeeper from Cadott. And he's also a teacher of beekeeping at the Beaver Creek Reserve and a member of the committee of the Chippewa Valley Beekeepers Community Apiary. Welcome to the show, Randy.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Stephen Anderson from Anderson's Maple Syrup. He owns Anderson Maple Syrup, and he's from Cumberland. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you.
And you can join the conversation today by calling 800-228-5615, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Well, I first wanted to start the show with a couple of introductions. Let's start with you, Randy Rickle. You wear many hats, two of which include beekeeper and educator. When it comes to your own beekeeping and honey sales, can you give us an idea of what you do?
Well, sure. I started out with a hobby, considering a hobby of beekeeping, and it turned into a small business 10 years ago with myself. I manage about 30 beehives, and most of which are on organic farms. And I choose to use no chemicals on my bees, and I produce liquid creamed honey and bee pollen for sale.
How did you get into beekeeping? How did you learn about it?
Ironically, I was traveling down the highway several years ago and listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and they were interviewing beekeepers. And they were talking about honeybees and beekeeping and environment and their plants and fruit trees and vegetables, and it intrigued me, so I got a couple of hives and got started.
You've also taught beekeeping at the Stanley Correctional Institution. Can you briefly tell us your experience working there?
Sure. This is the third year now. I participated out at Stanley Correctional. They have several inmates there that they're trying to put into programs to teach how to be beekeepers. And the goal is so that they would have employment when they exit the prison system and find a suitable occupation for them. So there's been about 25 to 30 inmates that have gone through the program the last 2-3 years. They have about between 8 and 10 hives out there on site, and they produce their own bees, their own honey, and extract their own honey. They sell a little bit of it there, and they use the rest of it in the prison system.
You've also traveled a bit to help new beekeepers learning the trade. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I had the opportunity to travel with a group called the Nicaragua Bee Project, and I went down to Central America, to Nicaragua, and spent 2 weeks down there working with a few other honeybee people and educators, and we put on some group programs to try and educate the general population down there that has interest in beekeeping and get them started in beekeeping and providing them some education and hands-on training for a couple weeks. I was down there 6 weeks all total, 3 different years, helping them people get started in beekeeping. For them, it's a real lucrative process. They can, with a little bit of luck, double their household income with a couple hives. So they're really interested in learning. And it's been a positive and rewarding experience to teach somebody about beekeeping. And they have African bees down there, so it's a little bit more exciting than it is up here, dealing with our regular Italian and Cornelian bees.
And Steve Anderson, can you give us a brief overview of your family's connection to maple syrup farming?
Sure. My grandfather grew up making maple syrup, actually a house that's just a quarter mile down the road from us. When he got married, they moved away and then came back when my father was born and bought the neighboring property to where they'd grown up. And that's really the date that we use for when we started our business, which is 1928. When they had moved away, they lived in Minneapolis, St. Paul area, and they made some connections there with people that later became involved in the grocery industry. And so that was kind of how our business started. When we started making syrup, when they started making syrup, they started selling to what is now known as the Lunds and Byerly's group. That was kind of one of their first big accounts, and it's grown from there. I took over from my father after graduating from college in the late 90s, and we've been kind of growing the business ever since. Stepping back a little bit, they had some dairy cattle, and then in the 50s they sold off the cattle that we had here, and just went full time into the maple syrup business, and at that time also started selling equipment supplies. So if someone wanted to make maple syrup, we would also supply equipment for them to make it, and then we would offer to buy back any extra syrup that they didn't need for themselves. About 5 years ago, we got out of the equipment business just to focus on the syrup selling business, and our syrup is sold around the country. I don't want to say everywhere in the country, but we're in several thousand grocery stores, primarily across the country, and then we do some food service for restaurants and ingredients for other products as well. But it's all maple syrup based. We do very little of anything else.
I want to shift our conversation now to how the environment impacts what you do as farmers. Randy Rickle, let's start with beekeeping. First of all, can you describe the process that bees go through in order to even make honey?
Sure. Well, bees will visit flowers, blossoms, and they're looking for the nectar within the flower of the blossom and also the pollen within the flower of the blossom. They take these two components back to their hive, mix it together, and that's what eventually forms your honey. So it's positive for the bees. They have some food and consumption, and it's definitely positive for our plants, our fruit trees, our agricultural crops. They increase the pollination of those buds and flowers by 30%. That's a positive.
You kind of touched on this, but how big of a part do pollinators like bees play in a successful harvest?
Well, they play a very significant role. If you have a crop of apple trees and you get 30% more apples from your crop, that's a pretty significant advantage. So honeybees and insect pollinators and the whole are very positive for your particular crop. If you produce almonds in California, honeybees are the only insect that pollinates almonds. So that generates significant portion of the entire country's honeybees are incorporated out there to pollinate the almonds. Around the countryside, bees, when you have commercial beekeepers, transport bees to fields of blueberries, fields of cranberries, fields of onions, fields of strawberries, during the time that those flowers are exposed, so that they get effective pollination and effectively get a positive crop. So as a whole, it's really important in our environment that we have honeybees and other pollinators, or we'd have the price of food would be up substantially and the volume would be less.
Lately, insects like bees and butterflies have seen populations decline. What's the reason for that? Randy, you're frozen or muted. Okay. Well, you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests today are Randy Rickle and Steve Anderson. Randy Rickle is the teacher of beekeeping at Beaver Creek Creek Reserve, and he's also a part of the committee of the Chippewa Valley Beekeepers Community Apiary.
Sorry about that.
You're fine. Are you back now? I can hear you. Okay. Well, Steve, let's talk with you a little bit more about maple syrup. The USDA says that the 2020 tapping season lasted about 29 days. What weather conditions make for a perfect tapping season?
You know, really, your neighbors should hate you for wanting to make maple syrup, because you're hoping for the worst possible conditions in the spring of the year, because that's the best possible conditions for making maple syrup. We like to have a little snow on the ground that kind of insulates the roots so that things don't thaw too quickly. But we also like to have a little thunderstorm to get the frost out of the ground a little bit quicker to get things going. But then after that thunderstorm rolls through, we want it to freeze hard the next night, because that pressure that is created by freezing builds pressure in the trees, which then when it thaws out the next day, it forces the sap out the little hole that we put in the tree, the spout or whatever we're using. So we're really looking for a lot of changes in barometric pressure. We'd like a thunderstorm one day. We'd like a snowstorm 2 days later. We'd like another thunderstorm, and then we'd like another snowstorm. And we like slushy messes. That's really what it amounts to. That's best for producing sap at that time of year.
Randy, it looks like you're back with us. We were having some technical difficulties. Before we lost connection, I wanted to talk about the reason that bees and butterflies have seen population declines recently. Can you explain what the reason for that is? Oh, you're muted.
Okay. A lot of it's environmental conditions that affect insects. You know, insects are indicators of problems with our environment. Unusual weather situations and chemicals are the two major things that are causing problems with our insects. Too much rain, too much heat, too much humidity, you know, is negative towards insects, and they're doing their little job and making their product. The chemicals that we use in our environment are definitely a negative to our honeybees in particular. It tends to mess up their brain activity and sometimes outright kills them. So we always encourage people to use a lot less or no chemicals in the environment if they can, or more natural chemicals in the environment, more sustainable products whenever they can. And always encourage people and educate people to that effect all the time. Whether you're a small time taking care of your lawn and your garden at around your house in town, or whether you're an agriculture producer, you know, with hundreds of acres of crops, you know, be conscious, be aware, follow your label directions, try and reduce and as much volume as you can.
A survey by the Chippewa Valley Beekeepers Association found that 51% of members had one hive or less come springtime. And the culprit? It was winter weather. How have you seen our more variable seasons, like dramatic winters and drier summers, impact your honey production?
Well, it's real necessary to have a real healthy population of bees going into the winter so that they hopefully survive for you. So the weather conditions and floral conditions in August, September, and October are very critical to the bees' overall health, and then in turn for their survival through the winter. They can tolerate very cold conditions, but they need to have some wind barriers and some insulation and protection around the hives to be successful through the winter. They need to have some treatments for mites, parasitic mites that affect the bees. And overall food supply adequate to make it through the winter, and then you cross your fingers. Over the years, genetics in the bees has been limited, and we're getting more bees that are from the southern United States and the California area of the country. And I don't think they're as adaptable to our Midwest winters as the bees we used to have years ago. So those three factors produce some losses over winter. So you typically end up with 35 to 40% loss of your bees. That's typical. Hopefully you don't end up with more losses than that. Some years it's you know, it's a crap shoot. Sometimes you do well, sometimes not so well.
Do you know what caused a decline in those Midwestern bees that you mentioned?
Well, they have a colony collapse disorder that caused the death of thousands of hives a few years ago, and that still is an active participant. I think there's a residual of chemicals in the hives in some producers that cause negative effects. The bees that gather nectar and pollen from flowers or plants that have been sprayed, they bring some of that to them with back to them to the hive with them. And then genetics. I think there are a combination of factors that cause the decline of bees.
Another problem for beekeepers can be a parasitic mite called the varroa mite. And that's actually been causing a lot of problems for commercial beekeepers. Do your hives feel any effect from this parasite?
Oh, yes. It's pretty much all over the place in everyone's hive. The varroa mites are a little parasitic creature that attaches to the body of the bee, and it consumes the fat bodies and the blood from the bee. And as it's there, consuming it like a wood tick would attack us, it creates a little hole and a cut, and they import some viruses and bacteria into that little site there. Some of them are not so significant of bacteria, and some of them are really lethal to the bees. So it's necessary to be successful to have some sort of treatment process in place where you're trying to remove the mites from the bees so that they can stay as healthy as possible through the winter for you.
There's this quote that's often attributed to Albert Einstein, but we don't know if he actually said it, and it goes like, "If the bee disappears from the surface of the earth, man would have no more than 4 more years left to live." What's your reaction to that quote? Do you think there's any truth to it?
Yes, there's a significant amount of truth to it. When you think of every time you grab an orange or an apple, a grape, cranberry, wheat, corn, soybean, all our products are made from these and other vegetables and fruits. If the volume was cut by 70 or 80% of all those crops all at one time, we'd be in a situation where we'd be in tough shape for a food supply. The cost would be outrageous. Some of these plants, you know, get pollinated by themselves or by wind or by accident or by other insect pollinators. But if you didn't have a significant amount of pollinators out there, there's going to be less fruit on all these fruit trees and all these vegetables that clearly affect us as human beings. So, yes.
And then what can someone who's not a beekeeper do to help the bees thrive and rebuild their populations?
Anytime you can, as a homeowner or a landowner, if you can plant some species that blossom and flower, ideally something that blossoms and flowers for a long time, maybe several days or several weeks, something that blossoms and fruits in the spring and in the fall, that's positive time periods for the bees. They're critical time periods for them for development. Most of us beekeepers will end up planting something close by our hives as a food source, a nectar and pollen source for our bees so that they are healthier and survive and produce a better crop. The same thing I would suggest any listeners out there today. If you can do that, if you're considering that, please do that. And then discontinue as much as possible the use of insecticides and pesticides. Go to natural components if you can. There's other means that you can remove weeds and insects and pests from plants. So try and be as environmentally conscious and aware as you can. It's good for the bees and other pollinators, which in turn is good for us and good for the environment as a whole.
Our guests today are Stephen Anderson of Anderson's Maple Syrup and Randy Reichel, a beekeeper and beekeeping instructor. We're discussing how changes in the environment and consumer behavior impact Western Wisconsin farmers. And you can join this conversation by calling 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-565. 5615, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. I'm Claire Neipert, and this is The West Side on the Ideas Network. Okay, now let's return to maple syrup. We talked before about what a typical tapping season looks like. Steve Anderson, I'm wondering, where are we at right now in the tapping season?
So this year was an unusual year. The season started earlier than it should have. We had those couple of weeks of really bitter cold. So that kept people from getting out into the woods to getting all the trees tapped that maybe they would have. It was still early, and it's not normally the time of year that people would be tapping. But it kind of put a rush on everyone coming into about the 1st of April. First of March, the sap started flowing as soon as it warmed up, and the season ended by the end of the month. Most syrup that was made in the first week of April was, you know, kind of that end of the season things that people use for cooking and so forth, and there wasn't much made. The crop in Wisconsin is down significantly from previous years, and along with most of the country, it's probably 2/3 to 3/4 of a crop across the country. And it was because the weather just didn't cooperate. It was super cold early on, which we could certainly recover from, but then it warmed up too fast, and then it didn't freeze for several nights kind of in the middle of the month. And that kind of gets the trees starting to think about budding out and coming back to life, essentially. And that really slowed down production. And then when it did cool off again, we just didn't get the reactions that we usually get. Wasn't as cold at night and maybe not as warm in the daytime. We need those big swings. And ideally, it gets down below 20 at night and it gets up, you know, into the 40s during the day. And we didn't have the ideal weather conditions this spring to make a good crop of syrup. What was made tastes great, but there was just less of it this year. So it's going to be an interesting season. I think similar to the 2020 season, that was a short year too, but the time that we did have, the weather cooperated a little bit better. We didn't get the weather that the neighbors hate as often as we'd like to have gotten. We didn't get the snowstorms in the middle of the season. We didn't get the thunderstorms when we needed them. And we didn't get those huge barometric pressure changes that are good for the sap flow.
Is there anything that farmers can do to adapt to maybe a not so great season and changes in their trees? Or are there different tapping techniques that could preserve that harvest?
Really, there's not a lot we can do. We're at the hands of Mother Nature. The best things that we can do, and I would say that 80% of the world's supply of maple syrup is probably made through this system already. But by putting tubing in the woods with a vacuum pump on it, we can artificially make that pressure change from inside the tree to outside the tree a little bit lower so the sap flows out better. And you could make an okay day into a good day and a good day into a great day, where if you just had buckets hanging on the trees, you kind of get what you get. And we can essentially add to the flow by putting that vacuum on the system. And most producers have already done that. But that's really about all we can do. You know, talk about chemicals and things like that. People have tried experiments in the past to say, well, what if we fertilized our trees and this and that, would that help? And really the research shows it doesn't work, doesn't help, which is good because, we'd rather not be putting those chemicals in the woods anyway. So there really isn't a ton you can do other than add vacuum.
I wanted to scale back a little bit. And can you describe how its sap comes from trees and then gets turned into maple syrup and shows up on our shelves at a store? What is that process?
Sure. I'll start right at the tree. The basic process there is in the spring of the year, and it actually happens in the fall too, but on a more limited basis, the sap in the tree changes. It's sweet because the tree is coming back to life, sending that nutrients up to the leaves to get them to sprout and bud. But when it happens is it freezes hard, then the pressure, the liquid that's in the tree freezes and creates pressure. And so when the outside temperature and pressure So when it thaws on the outside of the tree, but the tree is more dense, it stays cold longer. But actually, the pressure outside the tree is then less than inside the tree, and it pushes that sap out the hole that we create. And from there, we take that sap and we boil it. It's really fairly simple. There are a lot of places using reverse osmosis machines to remove some of the excess water from the sap prior to boiling it. Sap right out of a tree is usually in the 2-3% range. That's how much sugar is in it and mineral. And when we turn it into maple syrup, it has to be 66%. So there's a lot of water that has to be removed, and the reverse osmosis machines will actually filter out the water. Those machines were built to purify water, and we actually throw the purified water away, and we keep the stuff that would normally be considered the garbage, because that's the concentrated sap, the concentrated minerals, and then it takes a little bit less energy to boil it down, and we can cook it down a little bit faster. But essentially, it's just boiling to get rid of that moisture, extra water. Once it's turned into syrup, most of the syrup gets barreled up. You know, people put it in a 55-gallon drum, and they'll store it until they need it, and then generally gets reheated again. Make sure that the density is just right. It's not too thick, not too thin. And then it gets filled into a bottle hot and delivered to your favorite store.
How can the climate or climate change impact how that syrup tastes?
You know, it's hard to blame it exactly on climate change. We know it's a part of it, but we don't know exactly where that fits in. It's more looking at a season in particular. 2 years ago was a season where we had a lot of warm weather right in the middle of the season, and essentially that confused the trees. They started to try to bud early. And every bit of syrup made after that point had a funny flavor to it. And it was because the trees had started that budding process. And of course, the reason that the weather was too warm at the wrong time of the year is probably due to climate change. But, you know, climate change is such a slow, big cycle that, I don't know if cycle is even the right word. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what it's doing to us. There's some research being done that, you know, maples only grow in certain climates, and that climate is moving further north all of the time. And those that were on the extreme southern edge of the maple making world are having shorter and shorter seasons. So it's not necessarily always about affecting the taste. It's more affecting the quantity, but there are those rare occasions where the weather is just wrong, terribly wrong during the season. And you get some funny flavors that you have to figure out a different industry to sell it to, because you don't want it on your pancakes necessarily.
Lately, research has said that we are experiencing warmer and drier growing seasons. So like you mentioned, you need trees to make syrup. How mm-hmm. have you seen a change in tree growth here in Western Wisconsin?
Most of the trees that we tap in our industry are quite old, and maples are not a fast-growing tree anyway. My dad is always fascinated when he cuts down a tree. You know, we've got to get a nice smooth section of it so we can count the rings and see which ones are closer together and which ones are further apart. And then he'll try to correlate that with years in the past and how the syrup season went. I think the trees maybe aren't growing as quickly as they once were, but again, you know, some years are better than others for that. What we do know is nice, sunny, hot summers help make for more, helps the photosynthesis in the leaves of the trees, which is what's making the sugar. So we like those hot, sunny summers. And then we like to have some moisture in the fall, because we need some moisture in the ground for those trees to be able to absorb up once the ground thaws out in the spring. And that's the other reason we need thunderstorms in the spring, is to also put some of that moisture in. As the trees are starting to really suck it up, we want to make sure there's plenty there for it. So it's not a simple answer, because everything happens so slowly.
Some researchers worry that in the future there might be a shortage of maple syrup. Steve Anderson, do you foresee that problem happening?
Well, especially after a year like this one, it surely brings that to light. The next 12 months are going to be interesting as far as CERP prices are going to be going up, because there is going to be somewhat of a shortage. We believe there's enough in the reserves in different parts of the country and in Canada that there will be enough CERP to go around, but it's going to be short. And with the climatologists telling us, that where maple trees are going to grow in the future is further and further north, certainly there are people that are on the south end that, in the next 100 years, maybe they won't be making maple syrup, or at least they won't be able to make very much because their seasons will be too short. And the maple trees won't be as healthy because the climate isn't what the trees want. It's whether or not it's going to move so fast that maples, as a slow-growing tree already, are going to have time to kind of recover into their new environment and move farther north with the climate change. It's certainly a possibility that there will be shortages. I don't foresee it in our lifetime. I think it's further out than that. But there are things happening. There's some research being done about planting trees in a field. The production process is completely different. But they're looking at other opportunities on how you could make maple syrup from a maple tree. Still tastes the same. Similar process, but raising it more quickly so that you have a more of a renewable resource as far as using up the tree 1 year, and might get 3 years out of it. You cut down all these little shrubs and then you plant new ones for the next 3 years. It's a very interesting and weird way to think about maple syrup, but the industry is looking at things like that and other options in other parts of the country and world that possibly could make maple syrup in the future.
That is interesting. So the maple syrup trees you use now, are they more in a forest that we would typically think of, where it's randomized trees and shrubs? Do your fields look like that?
No, everything that's made at this point is all forests. And, the old forests are what's so good for our climate and for our, sucking up all that bad carbon monoxide and putting out good oxygen. New forests, a planted crop like I was kind of alluding to, wouldn't have that same effect. So most of us in the industry aren't excited about that prospect. And to this point, it doesn't look like it's going to pan out like they originally thought it might. But all maple syrup, as far as I know right now, is made in a forest setting. Some forests are bigger and older than others, and some are younger, but they're all in that type of a setting.
We're talking about how changes in the environment and consumer behavior impact Western Wisconsin farmers with Randy Rickle and Steve Anderson. Are you a big honey fan? Or maybe you have questions about the price of maple syrup? Call us at 800-228-5615 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Claire Neipert on the West Side. This is the Ideas Network. We're listening to The West Side on Randy Rickle. We discussed earlier about how important bees are to the prosperity of all crops. And much like large-scale dairy farms, there has been a growing concern about commercially managed honeybee colonies. Can you tell us about the impact these large-scale honey producers have on small-scale producers like yours, and the impact that they have on the environment?
Sure. Well, we need, as a community as a whole, need commercial beekeepers out there, because they run around the country doing pollination services for all our major crops that we have. Those are positive things. The negative thing is that they transport sometimes problems around the country and diseases and things that we really don't want to have. They control the market as far as the prices, because they're the volume of producers. They're larger cooperatives in that they control most of the market that goes out to the retail stores. The other side of the coin is the small-time, small-business hobbyist people that have a few hives in their backyard, or someone like myself that has less than a couple hundred hives. And we produce a crop and sales usually in our local areas. Those are kind of the differences. to smaller hobbyist beekeepers, and the small-time beekeepers often are the ones that are producing unique products or organic products if they can. Raw products is real popular nowadays. There seems to be an increased demand for raw, unfiltered, natural honey. There seem to be a lot of consumers that are trying to get away from the white sugar usage, and they're going to either honey sugar or maple sugar in their diet. They're looking for a healthy lifestyle in purchasing healthy foods. And many allergy sufferers seek out locally produced honey to aid in their allergies that they have for themselves. So yes, I think there's important distinctions. There's important different niches in our business environment for honey production.
You share some of your honeybees with area farmers. Can you describe the relationship that you've built with those farmers?
Mostly it's on my own properties. I have my 30 hives on different locations. Most of my hives are on organic farms. So we don't have to deal with the issues of insecticides and pesticides. They and I have a real clear understanding of what our goals are. The bees seem to do well at those locations. I market my honey as being produced on organic farms. It's not organic honey. You can't control how far the bees go in range to collect nectar and pollen. They generally go a mile, 2 miles, even 3 miles in distance in return. But if they find a food source that's close and nearby, hundreds of feet or half within a quarter mile, they will stay in that local area, gathering all the nectar and pollen they can from that area. So it's a very positive relationship with small-time farmers and hobbyist beekeepers with the total effect of producing a nice little local qualified honey.
Mm-hmm. Do they pay you to bring your bees to their fields, or do you pay them to set your hives down? Is there any like money exchange going on there?
Sometimes there's money exchange for pollination services. If a person takes a couple hives to a local orchard or something, sometimes there will be a money exchange for the value of that and the time and effort to move the hives and then return them, move them back. Oftentimes it's a kind of a good faith gesture that you supply the person that has the land that you're putting your bees on with several quarts of honey as kind of a thank you gift for allowing the bees there. They find a thank you in that they find better apples and better vegetables in their garden, and they notice the difference almost immediately the first year. So they're pleased that they have you there and handy for pollination for their crop. So that's a mutual positive feeling, I guess, for the most part.
Stephen Anderson, on your business's website, you list several ways that Anderson's maple syrup is committed to helping the environment. How do you help ensure that our forests are healthy in this neck of the woods?
You know, the biggest thing is forest management. Everybody that's in the maple syrup business hates to go out and cut down a maple tree that's still producing, but sometimes that's what it takes. Thinning out those trees that are at the end of their life cycle, clearing up and opening up space for the new younger crop to come up. And most maple producers that I know have, work with foresters and, have some sort of a plan in place to keep their forests as healthy as they can. And it's really amazing what you see happen. You cut down a couple of specific trees that open up an area, and 5-6 years later, sometimes even quicker than that, you'll notice production increases in that part of the woods because you've got, for one, you may have trees that grew faster than they would have. There's less competition for them. It just makes the whole ecosystem in the woods work better if you manage it properly.
The local food movement, also known as locavore, aims to encourage people to eat foods which are grown relatively close to where they're sold and prepared. Luckily for locavores, Western Wisconsin has a big history of agriculture and food production. So I'd like to ask each of you, how has the movement to buy local impacted what you do? Steve Anderson, let's start with you.
You know, most of the syrup that we've always tried, we don't make all of the syrup we sell ourselves. We buy from local producers. We buy some from out of state, but we try really hard to buy Wisconsin maple syrup as much as we can get. And so our system of doing things that way was already in line with the buy local programs, because we were supporting our local farmers. And so people that were buying our syrup on the shelf were in exchange supporting their local farmers as well. We have an interesting relationship with our farmers. They will take care of their crops. If they have a big crop and I don't need their syrup, I'm still dedicated to taking and finding a home for it or storing it until it is needed. And so that vice versa on a short season, the hope is that they will treat me the same and sell me their syrup instead of somebody else that comes along asking for it. It's kind of we don't sign contracts with our farmers, but we do everything we can to keep the money local and support the local industry, which in turn is kind of how we can market. We don't market that we're Wisconsin only maple syrup because we have some from out of state. But the Made in the USA part of our marketing has opened up doors in other parts of the country where the vast majority of maple syrup comes out of Canada. They make about 75% of the world's supply of pure maple syrup. So indirectly, by promoting our U.S. products, we're providing a local market on a regional and some semi-national basis. We don't have the same qualities that honey does, for allergies. As far as, our maple syrup is made in this area, it may have a slightly different taste, but it's not going to help medically with, like honey can do in that type of movement. So it's important. And we do what we can to provide and support our local producers.
Randy Rickle, you've described yourself as a hobbyist. How do you sell your honey?
Well, I sell in two different segments. I sell to 16 local retail markets, Whole Foods stores, et cetera, and retail shops. And I'm a local vendor at the Chippewa Falls Farmers Market, and it runs in the summer from June to October. I'm there every week. And I sell out of my home, being a small-time producer. So that keeps me busy with my little hobby business by itself. I sell, liquid honey and creamed honey and bee pollen. So I have a little diversification. And I sell to a kind of a market niche that people are looking for healthy lifestyle and healthy sugared products and allergy sufferers and people that are just looking for healthy alternatives to processed foods. So,
how have you found ways to continue to sell your honey with the absence of farmers markets due to the pandemic?
Well, that was really interesting. I market my product as something special from Wisconsin. I use that emblem because it is. I end up advertising also that it's principally made, harvested from organic farms. Word of mouth has been very helpful. I was lucky enough to win some blue ribbons at the state fair competitions. So I proudly display my ribbons when I can somewhere that it was successful for several years. Personal contact, they know who the food producer is when they speak to me at the farmer's market, when they speak to me at the grocery stores. And when just by reputation now after doing this for several years out of my home.
So do you package the honey yourself then?
Yes, it's all my honey that I produce. I produce it in anywhere from a 2-ounce size container to a 5-pound container or bulk products. Some are in glass jars. Some consumers prefer glass. Some consumers aren't so concerned, and some on plastic bottles for others. It's kind of a niche market. I'm a small-time person, small-time farmer doing this, just trying to supply a little niche for a little demand that I noticed out there. So,
Steve Anderson, what do you think the future holds for your profession? Have you seen younger generations become interested in maple syrup farming?
Yeah, there's been a lot of interest. I think the pandemic kind of helped a little bit too, because people were looking for hobbies, things they could do at home and stay away from other people. And so that really helped those that are still selling equipment. So they sold a lot of equipment, more than usual this year, to hobbyists. So, you know, whether or not they'll all stick with the industry, I don't know. But some of them will. Some of them will find that they really enjoy it and find that it's a nice income for them. This short crop, this season that I referred to earlier, is raising the bulk price that small hobby producers can get for their syrup. So they don't have to, if they don't want to, go out and try and retail it themselves. They can make a living at selling it this way. And this higher price, I think, will stick around for quite some time once it kind of gets its way worked through the system. And that will encourage more producers, more young producers to expand and make more syrup. The need is out there. People, you know, like Randy said, they're looking for healthy products that are good alternatives to, you know, the processed sugars that we're used to using. And maple syrup and honey both fit into that category nicely. And so I think there's a market there. I think there's a demand there, and that will bring those younger producers on. There was a story recently on local news of, I think he was a 16-year-old kid that had gotten a grant and put in a sugar house. And, you know, he had grand plans for expanding to be a big producer at some point. And I think that story is not as unusual as it used to be. So we're seeing a lot of that type of thing in our industry. So I think the future is really good. It's just, you know, we don't know exactly how we're going to get there.
What about you, Randy Rickle? Have you seen younger generations interested in beekeeping?
Yes, to some extent, younger people are interested. Recently, in the last few years, I find that people in their midlife area are thinking about a hobby and interest, want to have some bees in the backyard, want to feel positive about doing something positive for the environment and for the nature. They seem to be interested in developing their new little hobby of two hives in the backyard. So that's what I notice in teaching classes and talking to people that come up to buy honey. I think it's a very positive sign that they're thinking about the environment and conscious about bees and aware of the need for having pollinators out there. So yeah, not too many younger ones. It's a little cost prohibitive for young people to get in right away. We, as an organization, the Chippewa Eau Claire Beekeepers Club that I'm a member of, have noticed that, and together with a couple of corporate sponsors, have put together an apiary program out in Halley. And where we're encouraging young people to get started out there by helping them get most of their equipment needs and teaching at the cost of the club, not on their own, to get them started in beekeeping for a little bit of a hobby for themselves. So that's just touched off this year. And we hope that it'll expand, and it's kind of a one-of-a-kind thing.
Yeah. Steven Anderson, thank you so much for joining us today. Steven Anderson is the owner of Anderson's Maple Syrup in Cumberland. And thank you, Randy Rickle. He's a honeybee keeper, teacher of beekeeping at Beaver Creek Reserve, and on the committee of Chippewa Valley Beekeepers Community Apiary. Kate Spranger produced today's program, and Tommy McGowan managed publicity. Next week on the West Side, we discuss the problem of murdered and missing Indigenous women in western Wisconsin, and how some advocates are working to address that issue. And coming up next week on Spectrum West, the Eau Claire Public Arts Council and Visit Eau Claire Downtown Eau Claire are teaming up for a huge celebration of Creative Economy Month in May. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Claire Kniper, and this is The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio.